This is Fighting Bob Radio on Blog Talk Radio. We anticipate a guest this morning, John Boniface, who is a constitutional lawyer and has been working widely, in particular, on the matter of campaign finance and a variety of other projects that come before him. He is a constitutional lawyer, and I'm going to welcome John right now, and we'll be joined by Ed Garvey here shortly. Good morning, John Boniface.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
It's very good to have you on, and Ed Garvey is on as well. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning.
Good to all be on board here.
Is my friend John Boniface on?
I am, Ed. Good to hear your voice.
This is exciting to have you on with us because, as far as I'm concerned, you're the number one voice in the country on this move to amend.
Well, there's many voices, but I appreciate that, Ed, and it's great to connect with you on this work as you've been so involved in it for so many years.
I sure have. I keep losing, too.
No,
we need some victories
it's
here,
a,
John.
It's a long march, but, you know, I think we're on the right side of history.
Can you give us kind of an update as to where you are right now?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, this is a broad movement, of course, and there's many allies in the field. You know, Free Speech for People, we launched this campaign on the day of the Citizens United ruling more than 3 years ago. Move to Amend launched that same time frame, and then others have come on board, Common Cause, Public Citizen, People for the American Way, many local organizations, religious leaders, business leaders, unions, all have joined this call for a constitutional amendment that would overturn the Citizens United ruling, overturn the Buckley v. Valeo ruling of 1976 that equated money with speech, and make clear that we the people rule, not we the corporations, eradicating this fabricated doctrine of corporate constitutional rights that's so much a part of what the Citizens United ruling is about. And, you know, thus far, you know, in 3+ years, we've already gotten nearly one-third of the way there toward what's needed to send to the states for ratification and ratify a constitutional amendment, the 28th Amendment to the Constitution. 16 states are now on record calling for an amendment. We've been active in many of those states in getting those resolutions passed along with our allies. 500-plus cities and towns are on record. 2,000-plus business leaders, hundreds of religious leaders, over 125 members of Congress, and the President of the United States as well, who have joined this call for an amendment. But, you know, even beyond the amendment work, we have to keep pushing back in the courts, and we're engaged in doing that as well at Free Speech for People. We think it's important that we find continued dissenting voices from the judiciary that agree that this whole idea of corporations being treated as people under the Constitution,
so
bogus
ridiculous
jurisprudence. And we've assembled a very strong coalition of legal advisory supporters, of those who are in the academic field or in the practicing field, who are coming forward as scholars and as practitioners to agree that we have to take on this doctrine. And I think that, you know, we've got to deal with this in the courts, in the court of public opinion, and we certainly have to keep the grassroots pressure going for the broader amendment movement.
Who's leading the opposition in terms of the states and the cities and the counties and everyone else jumping on board?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of organic activity happening around the country, and some of it doesn't get met with much opposition. But where it comes up, it's really, you know, those who are the corporatists who believe somehow that corporations should be treated as people, that they need these constitutional protections. There are some who make the sky is falling argument that if we had this kind of an amendment, we would do away with our economy. We would no longer have corporations being able to engage in contracts.
You're living in caves.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing about this that is so false is, of course, we're not talking about federal and statutory laws that name corporations as persons. So, for example, the Clean Air Act names corporations as persons so that we can hold Exxon and Mobil and others accountable when they violate the Clean Air Act. Now, it's a separate question whether we're really enforcing that act sometimes, but the fact is that we do have reasons to name corporations as persons under federal and state laws. That's not what this is about, nor is it about eliminating contract laws or anything like that. But it is about making clear that when it comes to the supreme law of the land, the United States Constitution, and our political rights, they are designed solely for natural persons, not for artificial creatures of the state.
John, if I may, the with the organization, the National Voting Rights Institute, you served as a general counsel of that. One of your efforts is to ensure the rights of people to vote, and we're seeing so many attacks on that right to vote. These extraordinary, it would seem, rights have been granted to corporations to spend money and to be seen as people, but the people themselves, are their right to vote and take part in the electoral process is being challenged all over the country. And here in Wisconsin, it will be coming up again in the next session of the legislature here to enforce new voting requirements, ID requirements, and other restrictions on voting, which challenge the right of people to even make a choice, even if those choices are being determined by the corporate class and being supported by big money.
Yes. Well, you know, it's certainly a huge concern, the state of the right to vote and the challenges that we face with voter suppression efforts. I should say that the National Voting Rights Institute has since merged back in 2007 with DEMOS, a New York-based policy center, and I'm not there anymore. I did start it in 94, and Ed Garvey actually was on our National Board of Advisors from day one, and I was thrilled to start to get to know him from that, and appreciate all the support, Ed, you provided for that. But we did over a good 12-plus-year period engage in challenging the campaign finance system in court on voting rights grounds and defending the right to vote in other contexts. We actually helped to lead the effort in Ohio for a recount of the presidential vote in 2004 that never actually was done in a meaningful way, but that was an important fight. And what we see today are continued efforts to suppress the vote. Voter ID laws are example A, but there are many other examples in which the right to vote is under attack. And, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court recently gutted the key provision of the Voting Rights Act, on the eve
wasn't
of this 50-year... What's that?
So wasn't that a tragedy?
It was outrageous. Outrageous. Yeah. And, you know, Congressman John Lewis, who's the last surviving speaker from the August 28, 1963 March on Washington, which, of course, is coming up with the 50th anniversary, he's been very clear about how outrageous that ruling was and how people fought and died for that Voting Rights Act law, and for the court to now claim somehow that we no longer need that provision that would essentially require pre-clearance of voting changes in a certain number of states that have a long-standing history of discrimination in voting, that's just flat out wrong from the facts. That these states we now see right after that ruling, many of these states are immediately implementing these restrictive voter ID laws because they've now been given the green light to do so.
Yeah,
and I hope that it is. I mean, the Justice Department and Eric Holder, Attorney General, is saying they're still going to try to go after these laws in other ways via the Voting Rights Act, but that's a whole other fight that needs to take place, which is to reestablish that provision, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. But I have to say, more importantly, we have to get to that fundamental point that many have called for, which is a right to vote in the Constitution itself. We're one of 10 Democratic countries out of 110-plus Democratic nations that does not have that language in our Constitution, and newer democracies have it. We go out and celebrate those newer democracies, but we don't even have that language in our own Constitution.
Isn't that amazing? God.
It is.
Well,
and
it's exciting to see the progress you're making, John. Because
thank you, Ed. We're thrilled to be part of this with people all across the country, and I do believe ultimately, we will be on the right side of history. It may take some time, It took a long time, obviously, for some of these other amendments to get enacted. But at the end of the day, you know, I don't think we're going to give up on the promise of government of, by, and for the people.
Good for you.
I'm sure that many, John, would be startled to know that our Constitution does not have the provision which gives to give people the right to vote.
It doesn't. And you know, actually, Justice Scalia, if people want to go back and look at Bush v. Gore, the ruling that he issued, he was quite clear on this. He said there is no individual right to vote for the electors of the President of the United States. Now, that also deals directly with the Electoral College, but his point was, and therefore, you know, we don't have to keep the
recount.
Anything goes. Yeah, we don't have to keep the recount going in Florida because it's all about the Electoral College and we're going to stop this recount. And
this
that should
really
have been, you know, the clearest example why we need to put it in the Constitution when we had that decision come down.
Is there any movement for a constitutional convention?
Well, there are some voices for this, and you know, I know that in certain states like Minnesota, there's a conversation happening on that. You know, we're of the view at Free Speech for People that we don't need to go down that route, and it has clear mm-hmm. dangers when we do go down that route. Because it puts on the table any other potential amendment.
Exactly.
But it's important to note, historically, that the 17th Amendment, which transferred the election of senators from our state legislatures, which are getting corrupted and so forth, to the people, that amendment, which was, of course, a pro-democracy amendment, that only happened after the threat of a convention. And so I think that there's you know, important debate to have happen in this country about this, but we're not – you know, issuing that call, and most of these states are calling for Congress to pass and send to the states for ratification an amendment bill.
I think that's the right way to go. We're going to have some fun at Fighting Bob Fest. John, I'm sorry you're not going to join us this year, but we're going to be asking our people to get more active and to actually follow the lead of North Carolina by having Moral Mondays on topics such as what's happening here with the voting rights and suppression of the vote and so on.
Yes. I think that's great. I think we should take Tomorrow Mondays and export it around the country. I think we need more street heat and we need more public engagement on these critical questions. We're, you know, we're only going to preserve our republic and defend our democracy if we stand up and fight.
You may not know this yet, but Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive, was arrested in our state capitol for watching the demonstrations out there with people singing subversive songs like Solidarity Forever.
He was arrested for watching it.
Yeah, he was covering it for The Progressive.
Yeah, I mean, he clearly was a threat to security there and needed to be arrested, I would imagine, right? I mean, standing there and watching it.
People were really afraid. Here comes The Progressive.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. No, really, this is the kind of thing that has to be stopped, right? I mean, the kind of infringement on our liberties that's happening in these kinds of situations has to be stopped. And you know, I think what's going on in North Carolina is a clear indication of what's at stake. You have a phenomenally wealthy guy there named Art Pope, who single-handedly really has used his funds to try to take over the North Carolina government, and people are waking up and they're going to respond as rightly they should. With the kind of street heat they're applying every Monday.
Well,
even every other day. I mean, you know, when we listen to Congressman Lewis and the fight that needs to keep happening here, we're reminded, you know, we may be about to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, but we have so much more work to do to lift up that promise of American democracy.
Well, it's going to have to have quite an impact because as people look at what's going on, they're not stupid. I mean, Bob LaFalle used to say, never overestimate the knowledge of the American people, but never underestimate their intelligence.
Right.
I think if you think about this, and you see one of the two political parties going all out to suppress the vote, people know what's going on. I mean, it's not like they're going to be surprised.
Yeah.
I think it's going to backfire on the Republicans.
I do too, and I think, you know, I view this, of course, from a nonpartisan lens, but I think there are entrenched Democrats who need to, be challenged as well. I mean, I just think that we've got to take on the entire system as it is engaged in trying to stifle competition, whether through the big money and politics system. You know, the problem with big money in politics, of course, is that it works for those who are in power.
Yeah.
They raise the money, they stay in power, they discourage any competition. And that's across the aisle, as you know. And that I think, is why we've got to take it head on, and why an amendment fight is the way to do it.
Well, and I think the biggest danger we have are people who say, oh, we can't win. The amendment will take too long, or we don't have the strength. They've got all the money. And I think we can't allow ourselves to become cynical about the prospects simply because they have more money than we. They've always had more money than we have.
Well, absolutely. You know, I mean, I tell you, Ed, I tell this story, and I know you know it, but, you know, for your listeners out there, about Granny D, Doris Haddock, who always came to, you know, Fighting Bob Fest, who was such an inspiration. At the age of 89, she decides she's going to walk across the country to overhaul our campaign finance system. She sets out from California, walking 10 miles a day. She didn't have any grand plan as to how she was going to do this, how she was going to be housed, how she was going to be fed. She just started to walk. She knew the general direction she was supposed to go. But she just started to walk. And random strangers came out of their homes. They housed her. They fed her. They walked with her for part of the way. She walked through the rain, through the wind, through the snow. 14 months later, 3,200 miles later, she turning 90 in the process, she reaches Washington, D.C. to be greeted by then-Senator Russ Feingold and Senator John McCain,
right,
and hundreds of others there that day. I was honored to be among those greeting her that day, and I was honored to have known her like you. And, you know, she passed away, as you know, in March of 2010, 2 months after the Citizens United ruling, and you probably know she thought about walking across the country again when she heard about that ruling at the age of 99. But you know, when she turned 100, she passed away in March of 2010, and I thought about the fact that when she was born, the 19th Amendment, guaranteeing women the right to vote, had yet to be enacted. She saw in her lifetime 9 amendments passed by 2/3 of the Congress, ratified by 3/4 of the states. She is an example that change can happen in a lifetime, including a constitutional amendment. I think in the name of Granny D, it's time for a 28th Amendment to the Constitution.
I love it. I love it. You articulated it so well. And I'll never forget Granny D when she said, you know, you've got to stand up in these legislative hearings and say, Senator, or some of you cannot vote on this because you've taken money from the other side. And she said, just don't sit around and complain. You've got to either get active or go home. Which I thought
absolutely. She's absolutely right. And I think people, you know, are doing that. They are standing up, and they're doing it in their local communities and all across the country. Some of it's not getting reported, but, you know, we're tracking it along with our allies, and we see an organic, growing grassroots movement to defend our democracy out there.
Yeah, you know, you probably know this, but Bernie Sanders is going to be our special speaker at Bob Fest, and I can't think of anybody who's better at this than Bernie.
He's a great leader on this question. I'm glad he's going to be there. That's great.
John,
Eric, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, please. John, the amount of money in politics is expressed in a variety of ways. We have, for example, the Grover Norquist. I almost hate to invoke his name, but he asks people to sign his no tax pledge. Now, here in Wisconsin, there are at least two, one senator, Ron Johnson, and 7th District Congressman Sean Duffy have signed on to his no climate tax pledge, no new taxes to fight climate change. The way that money infects the political process seems to know no limits, even in the face of not just political power, not directly in any case, but good science and necessary science.
It's an excellent point. I mean, I think that's exactly right, that what we have here is a system that is so corrupted and so driven by the interests of big money and corporate interests that we don't really have good public policy as a result. So whether it's healthcare, economic justice, education, protecting the environment, you know, jobs in the economy, foreign policy questions, so much of the time it's tied to what the big money and corporate interests want, not what's good for the American people, not what's good for the country. And I think that's a good example of it. I mean, we see, frankly, every day the impact of climate change, the dangers that we're facing, and the science that's backing it and demonstrating that. And yet we have these, Luddites, if you will, you know, who are in Congress and elsewhere trying to claim that, you know, we don't need to do anything on this.
I always have the feeling that these corporations, these corporate executives don't have any children or grandchildren, because if they did, they wouldn't be so crazy with something like the Norquist idea, no tax for climate change, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, another good example where this is so wrong is, you know, the effort to have some basic gun control that even the gun owners support. So, you know,
right.
Polling of the membership of the NRA shows that they support background checks. They support some basic gun control measures. But, you know, the NRA management is essentially a shill for the gun manufacturing companies. And that's what they are. They're not really representing their membership. They're actual people who are gun owners. And so we get, you know, 89%, 90% of the people ready for this kind of gun control measures to make our streets safer, to police support it, all these kinds of things, and we can't get it through Congress because of the power of big money. And that is really the story of why we don't have any further gun control after what happened in Connecticut so tragically last year.
Well, and when you have LaPierre saying the only thing that will stop a bad man with a gun is a good man with a gun, I'm thinking, yeah, could you please go away?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it's not reflective of even where his membership is. That's the point. And I think they have to be called out on this, and people look at it and say, oh, well, they have many people around the country who support them. But at the end of the day, they are providing, you know, the smokescreen for the companies that back
right.
them. Smith and Wesson, all these companies that are the gun manufacturers that profit off of not having any meaningful gun control. That's what this is really a story. It's a big money story. You take a look at healthcare. I mean, healthcare is another example where, you know, we have, you know, an industry that makes business off of providing healthcare coverage, and we don't have a meaningful conversation in this country, as we should, about single payer healthcare or even the public
right.
option because of big money interests.
Exactly. I mean, the absurdity of it. Go ahead, Eric.
John, here in Wisconsin, and Ed, on the program here at Fighting Bob Radio, we've spoken about it often, and that is, well, clearly the money that has been pouring into a variety of interests in Wisconsin, but in particular, an iron mining bill passed this past year, which will open the door for a variety of mining projects in the state, but most notably, the first one on the list is the largest open pit iron ore mine in the world, is only at the headwaters of the Bad River, which flows into Lake Superior through the Bad
yeah.
River Reservation, Bad River
yeah.
Chippewa into the Chittagan Sluice. As our friend, and I'm sure you know him well, Mike McCabe of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, by tracking
yeah.
the money here, revealed that $16 million. Came from supporters of that company-written mining bill. $25,000 was contributed to candidates who opposed it. And what we're seeing in Northwest Wisconsin, I believe, is that the corruption of this process, that corrupt process, clearly company-driven, business-driven, not being driven by the politicians, but being driven because that's where they're getting the money from, has begun to offend so many people in this region
yes.
of Northwest Wisconsin and in the state that the lie is being revealed. We can see that the emperor or the empire has no clothes. It is making a difference. It seems that people are seeing that that the politicians are on the wrong side of this, and they do not have the people's interest in mind, but they have the corporate interests in mind.
Absolutely. In fact, I learned all about that when I was at the last Fighting Bob Fest last year, finding out about that bill and the efforts to push back against it. So I think it's an important story. I mean, Montana, you know, as we know, is one of the states that came out for an amendment via a ballot initiative that we joined with Common Cause to put on the ballot there last November. And, you know, that vote, 75% of the people there voting for that ballot initiative calling for an amendment to make clear corporations are not people, money doesn't equal speech, that vote was across the political spectrum. You had people on the Republican side, independent side voting for that. 55% of the voters came out for Mitt Romney for president, 75% voted for our ballot initiative. And they have a history, as you know, that is about challenging the copper barons and corporate interests in Montana. And they had a law on the books for 100 years that banned corporate money in elections. And even after Citizens United, the Attorney General, now Governor, Steve Bullock, courageously said, you know, I'm going to defend this law. You can try to sue me, but I'm going to keep enforcing this law. I think it's different for Montana. And he got sued. And we went to his defense, and he won a state Supreme Court ruling in December 2011, making clear that Montana's law was based on different facts and therefore should be upheld. And they even made clear that they disagreed with the Citizens United ruling. And then the U.S. Supreme Court just reverses without even a hearing, without even having any argument, quickly just disposes of the whole matter, and the law has been removed. And so now you have open West season there, and you know, in terms of corporate money going into Montana elections. People are angry. That's why they voted for that ballot initiative. But I agree, people are waking up to the dangers here that are posed to our democracy when we allow these artificial creatures of government that we create, that we allow to exist, to effectively take over our government and our democracy.
And they have.
They have. And you know, the only thing that's going to change it is by people standing up and fighting back. And, you know, to your point, Ed, about, you know, kind of the schism that sometimes is out there, I mean, we just have to remind people of the history, you know, the fact that women didn't get the right to vote because men in power thought it was a good idea, you know, and we didn't bring down Jim Crow because whites in power thought it was a good idea to end Jim Crow. I mean, these changes occurred because of broad-based democracy movements, people fighting, standing up for this kind of change.
I couldn't agree more.
And may I, John, you, in 2004, you wrote a book, Warrior King, The Case for Impeaching George W. Bush. You served as a counsel for a coalition of soldiers and parents of U.S. soldiers. John Doe, president, was a challenge to the authority to wage war. As our friend and Ed referenced him, Matt Rothschild said once, we were led into this war in Iraq, Afghanistan, on a leash of lies. Now we've seen the prosecution of Private Bradley Manning for releasing documents to WikiLeaks. 35 years in prison is his sentence. Contrast that to the illegal war launched on a leash of lies by George Bush and his minions. Just share with us your thoughts, if you would, on the contrast, the hypocrisy, it would seem.
Yeah, well, you know, what happened there around the Iraq War is really, in my view, a democracy question, right? Because at the end of the day, we don't go to war, or at least we're not supposed to go to war, unless the people decide through our elected representatives in Congress that we go to war. That's what the framers set out. They were quite clear with the War Powers Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, Congress shall have the power to declare war. That was there because you had the kings and queens of Europe sending their subjects off into battle, often on their own personal whim. And so there was a determination that this nation, this new nation, would go to war in a different way, only through the people deciding through elected members of Congress. It's true that we haven't followed the mandate of the War Powers Clause for a number of years now, dating back to the Korean War, where Truman basically just went ahead without a declaration of war or anything of the equivalent action. But what happened with Iraq took it to a whole new level, because here you had, for the first time really, in a very vocal and public way, this preemptive war doctrine being applied, namely that, you know, we could engage in a first strike invasion of another country based on a threat that that country might pose to our own security. And when you apply that doctrine, even more so is it necessary to ensure that this is being done in accordance with the War Powers Clause, because otherwise it leaves it up to one person, namely the president, to tell us what the facts are, what the evidence is, to apply that doctrine. And that's essentially what happened.
And no one should have that much power.
No one should have that much power. And that's essentially what happened, is that Congress unlawfully delegated to the President of the United States the decision-making power, unlawfully, as to whether or not to go to war. He tells us, George W. Bush tells us, that we need to do this. Connie Rice goes, Connally Rice, the National Security Advisor, goes on television and says we're, you know, seeing the threat of a mushroom cloud over the United States. You know, Colin Powell makes this despicable presentation before the United Nations, presenting all this falsehood evidence. You know, George Tenet, the CIA director, seated behind him. We now know all these things were false. These were lies. And we did not have the proper process in place that the framers put in there for vetting this, to have Congress make this decision, not hand it off to the President of the United States. And so it was an illegal war. It was unconstitutional from the day one. And it's a tragedy that you have so many lives, thousands of lives on the American side, hundreds of thousands of lives on the Iraqi side impacted by this loss for this illegal and unconstitutional war. I was proud to be part of that case that we brought on behalf of soldiers and parents of soldiers and members of Congress. And, you know, while the courts ducked the whole issue and they stayed on the sidelines not to interfere with the president's march into war, I think it's another example of where we have to fight to defend our democracy, because at the end of the day, the question here is how we go to war is a democratic question. It's a question of whether or not we're going to do it in accordance with our Constitution, the democracy principles laid out there, or whether we're going to have the power of a king placed in the executive office of the President of the United States to send us into war. And that's essentially what happened.
Your thoughts on Bradley Manning,
I think that I stand with Daniel Ellsberg on this. I'm speaking outside of Free Speech for People now because we're not involved in these questions, but I stand with Daniel Ellsberg on saying that he is Bradley Manning. I mean, I think, you know, it's an outrage that somebody who revealed the truth that the world needed to know about the lies that the American government has told about Iraq and Afghanistan now faces this kind of punishment. He is a whistleblower. If he had provided those documents to the New York Times instead of WikiLeaks, I think there would be a very different kind of discussion going on in the country. But because he ended up not getting through at that time, as I understand it, to the major papers, and he provided over to WikiLeaks, we somehow are trying to assign Julian Assange and Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden these traitor-type labels. It's an absolute outrage. You know, the people
have
a right
to know. When you think of things like the surveillance that's going on, and
yes,
that's been being run by private corporations. So here you have Booz Allen making decisions about who should see the most secret documents that we have in government, and yet they would send someone to prison for 35 years if you reveal that these secrets exist.
Right.
This is
the point. I mean, there needs to be accountability here for the you know, illegal and unconstitutional acts that are taking place by our own government and by their contractors via these companies. And the surveillance that's happening is a strict violation of the Fourth Amendment right to privacy, no search and seizure without a government warrant. I mean, this is outrageous that our emails, our phone records are all open to being searched and are being searched. And were it not for Edward Snowden, we wouldn't even know that. So, you know, instead of calling him a traitor, these people, you know, who are calling him a traitor should look back at some of the prior, you know, heroes and heroines of our history who have called out, you know, our government for the lies that they make when they engage in that, and hold them accountable. That's what really needs to happen here. And we need a national conversation around accountability for the acts that have occurred both abroad and now domestically since September 11th.
And we're not having any of those conversations, as far as I know. I mean, perhaps they are on the East Coast or the West Coast, but somehow here in the heartland, I don't hear people making these kinds of arguments. And we've got to get them engaged in the process of deciding, well, how are we going to go to war if we ever go to war again? How do we verify that the information is correct that we're relying on before we send our young people over there to be killed?
Right.
These are issues that are so important, but they just seem to float by, and there's no leadership right now in either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party to have that conversation. And the Republican Party is just whether or not they're going to let the Tea Party folks destroy the party altogether.
But you had an interesting situation just a few weeks ago on the floor of the House, where you had Congressman Justin Amash, who's a Tea Party Republican, join with Congressman John Conyers Jr., obviously progressive Democrat, and they had an amendment to the authorization for funding for the National Security Agency, the NSA, that's engaging in all the surveillance, that would effectively defund this whole surveillance program. And they came very close with that amendment to winning that vote. And the White House put out all the force to stop it, to make sure that the vote came out their way.
To ask the president, what in the world are you doing?
Well, obviously. I mean, he's a former constitutional law professor. You wonder, where does he think he's going with his legacy, let alone anything else? I mean, does he really want to be the president who went even far beyond George W. Bush in violating the Constitution when it came to these surveillance questions and these drone attacks? You know, we don't even have any clear, answer now as to, what the authority is that the United States government claims it has to assassinate an American citizen abroad. We don't have any clear answer to those questions.
Isn't it interesting that they released the information about the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran and Arbenz in Guatemala just recently, just proving what we've all known for years. But interesting to see that they finally devolved some of the details, and it never would have happened if it weren't for Snowden and others with these access to this information.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, look, these are very challenging times for those who believe in the Constitution and our democracy. But I actually do think there are people across the board who across the political spectrum who share that common vision in our defense of our liberties and defense of our democracy, and. I have to believe that kind of vote that almost went the right way on the floor of the House is an example of what's to come. I think there is going to be a continued revolt to this kind of blanket violations of our rights under the Constitution.
I do too.
John, just after noon today, Central Time, there will be people gathering in the rotunda of the state capitol in Madison, gathering likely in a group larger than 20, and some number of them will be arrested, violating what a federal judge said is a reasonable requirement, and that is that any number of persons over 20 need to have a permit to demonstrate, to gather in a group with a common cause in the state capitol. Some number are going to be arrested. There is some debate, even among some progressive circles, about whether or not people should simply apply for the permit. After all, a federal judge said that's a reasonable thing. People who are demonstrating and singing their solidarity forever or whatever are saying, no, this should not be a requirement. What are your thoughts?
I think the whole question of getting a permit for a demonstration really has to be presented in the context of what's the permitting process for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're dealing with a public institution like the state capitol or a public park, is there a security question involved? Is there a need for police detail? What is the reason why these permits are needed? I don't believe that any demonstration that occurs in the United States needs to have a permit. I don't share that view. And I do think sometimes the claim for a permit is presented as a way to try to bar the actual demonstration. You don't get the permit in time, or it comes with a restriction that you have to be in some kind of protester's box, you know, miles away from where, you know, the official is that,
well,
you want to have hear the message. I mean, that's the other thing, right? I mean, you go sometimes to see some of these, you know, demonstrations, and you're all put into a box, you know, many blocks away from, you know, where the convention's happening, where the speech is happening, where that has to occur. So, I don't know enough about what was decided by that federal judge and what the reason is for the permit in Wisconsin, but I'm suspicious. When,
yeah, it should be.
You know, right, when we're talking about a public institution like the state capitol, and, you know, it's one thing if people are going to go in there and engage in, you know, trying to break up a hearing and so forth. That's a different question. But if they're in a space that's public and they want to try to be heard, I think that the deference should be toward the First Amendment values there, not toward some claim for a permit.
When I look back to the early civil rights days when, as a president of the National Student Association, I was an alternate board member of SNCC, we didn't ask for permission to sit in. Just to think
absolutely
of the absurdity
right.
of this, knocking
yeah.
on the door and saying, excuse me, sir, we have several Negroes here who would like to sit in your establishment. Do you have any problem with that?
Yeah. Well, you know, when
I get a permit.
Yeah, I mean, one of the first things that happened when I went to college is Grenada got invaded, and that was under Ronald Reagan.
Did we win that war?
What's that?
Did we win that war?
No, I don't think so. Right? But basically, Ronald Reagan invades Grenada without, again, any declaration of war and no congressional involvement, and this happened basically a few weeks after I got to college. So, you know, I was so outraged by this. I went about my dorm room, you know, floor there, and I got everybody in agreement we need to march. And we were going to march down to the federal courthouse in Providence, Rhode Island. This was at Brown University. And we were going to protest the Grenada invasion. And we didn't really know any of the student groups on campus. We had just gotten there. We were first-year students. But, you know, we got the whole dorm to get out there and march. And then all of a sudden, all these, you know, juniors and seniors found out about the march. They started jumping into the march and everything. And the one thing I did do, and it wasn't because I wanted permission, but I figured, you know, it would look good and it would help to have some police detail escort us to the federal courthouse. So I did call, you know, the Providence police, and I said, you know, we're going to have a demonstration and we would like you to show up and escort us. So we had a very nice escort of police cars and everything. And I think there's value there. The one thing that, you know, was pretty clear while we were on our way marching is I had no idea, none of us who were first-year students had any idea where the federal courthouse was. So I as we're marching, I turned to someone and I said, do you know where we're going? You know, nobody knew, and the police were just going wherever we wanted to go. So finally somebody in the back who was a senior jumped to the front and led us to where we were planning to go.
John,
that's great story.
What's that?
We started the program a little bit late, and as a result, we've had standing by John LaForge of the organization Nuke Watch, and I think I have a rather convenient segue here. If I might bring John LaForge in of the Nuke Watch organization, which is part of the Progressive magazine, Progressive Foundation, John Bonifaz, Ed, John LaForge, John, who recently returned from Germany, where he participated in a demonstration, and I think it's interesting to contrast the way that they were treated there, if there are some contrasts. John LaForge, we've got about 8 minutes left in the program.
Good
John,
morning.
Are you there?
Yeah, good morning. Am I coming in?
Yes,
yes,
John,
I hear you.
We hear you. Hi, John.
Hi, John. Hi, Ed. Hi, Eric.
Good
John,
day.
Tell us about the demonstration there. It regarded nuclear weapons, but the opportunity to speak out, to be a part of an organized demonstration, protest, civic action, tell us about it.
Yeah, it was treated much differently than similar demonstrations are treated here in the States. Oftentimes, and most generally, just as you've been discussing, there's a judicial overreaction to even the slightest civil protest if it involves illegal activity. Last weekend, or about 10 days ago, August 11 and 12, about 150 people out of a larger group of 750 who were demonstrating at the Bushehr Air Force Base, blockaded all nine gates to this large Air Force Base, which maintains the Tornado jet bombers, that still, 25 years after the Cold War has been done, fly the B-61, a U.S. nuclear weapon. 20 of them are deployed at this base. And the demonstration was, again, a call to withdraw these hydrogen bombs and return them to the U.S. and abolish nuclear weapons in general. As I say, all nine gates to the base were blockaded for a 24-hour period, and yet no arrests were made. The police obviously were given a hands-off policy for that weekend. They allowed the base to be blockaded. No traffic came in and out for 24 hours, and they just waited us out. In contrast, you know, the simple trespass actions Nuke Watch and other groups in the Coalition to Stop Project ELF conducted, simple trespass block sitting in the road for a blockade always resulted in arrest and eventually some serious charges that resulted in 6 months in county jails just for a simple trespass action.
Then we go to war to tell the rest of the world that we are the leading force for democracy in the world, and they should follow us right to the ramparts. It's quite remarkable.
It is remarkable. I prefer to recall Martin Luther King's statement that not the force for democracy, but the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. I think that still applies to us this day. In the case of these nuclear weapons, we're the only country in the world that deploys nuclear weapons in other states. We have 90 hydrogen bombs in Italy, 90 in Turkey, another 20 in Belgium, 20 in the Netherlands, and these 20 in Germany that were just now protested with a large demonstration, an annual demonstration, and yet the first one ever to completely blockade this particular Bushehr Air Force Base.
What has been the reaction to European colleagues or others that you met with respect to what's happened in Japan?
Oh, my gosh. You know, Europe was heavily contaminated with the Chernobyl catastrophe in 1986, so they're much more attuned to what's going on in Japan and the severity of the contamination of the water and the landscape there since the March 11th, 2011 Fukushima disaster. The Europeans' news coverage of what's happening in Japan is much better than in the United States, too. Germany, in particular, has positively non-nuclear, anti-nuclear position of planning to phase out all 17 of their power reactors by 2023, and they're moving ahead with its replacement by the use of solar panels and massive federal subsidies to put up wind turbines. And this is partly a response. The shutdown order by the government is a response to what happened in Fukushima and what's ongoing today.
You know, John Bonifaz, John LaForge, you know, as Ed has said, one of the goals of the Fighting Bob Festival this year, one of the aims is to organize, if I could use the term, a cadre of, you know, persons of the Fighting Bobbers to do as what you're describing people there in Germany and yourself did, John, and that is to actually take physical action, to be there, to be present. John Bonifaz, you've been engaged, in the legal fight, but obviously with many others. Organization is a tough one, isn't it? I mean, it takes hard work, grassroots from the bottom up. Ed, you know that from your days as a student and a student leader. And I'm always looking for,
I lost you. There's some kind of a...
Well, no, you know what it is? It's a C5A that's going over Amherst, Massachusetts. That is exactly what's going on. But sorry for that background noise. I think the point you're making is an important one, which is that these kinds of movements do require organizations like Nuke Watch, like Free Speech for People, in order to be anchored, in the day-to-day work of organizing and moving everything forward. And even obviously in prior movements, we see the value of those kinds of organizations. Civil rights movement had the NAACP, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. many other groups. And I think that that's what is so important today is, you know, that Fighting Bob Fest really helps to highlight is the value of the, of organizing together for change. I mean, we certainly have a lot that we can do on our own, individually in our communities, but we're all more powerful when we bring people together and organize together for change.
I couldn't agree more, and I think that one of the things we should be thinking about is so many people today think that if they send an email that they've discharged their responsibility for bringing about change in our society. And it takes more than an email. It takes people meeting each other and taking on the powers that be through demonstrations, through people getting arrested or whatever it might be. But it's got to be more than just sitting in the comfort of your home and hitting a button for peace.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, nuclear threats are that sort of critical issue and critical concern that can move towards some critical mass, perhaps, to bring people, into the streets and, off of the email list, I guess. John Boniface, great having you on Fighting Bob Radio today. John LaForge, thank you as well. John, how do people get engaged with you, John Boniface, and the work that you're doing? What's a great place to
direct? They can go to our website, freespeechforpeople.org, and sign up, get our updates, and get involved. We'd love to have people join us. We have tens of thousands of people all over the country already on board via our site, but many other groups out there. And I think, it's an honor to be on this program and talk with all of you. I think we all need to keep fighting to protect our democracy.
John, thank you very much.
Yeah, people can look at our website too, nukewatchinfo.org.
Excellent.
Thank you, John LaForge.
Ed, all be well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Thank you. Keep
See
on.
See you at Bob Fest.
Okay.
Thank you very
much. You've been listening to Fighting Bob Radio, broadcast each Thursday from 11 until noon, and you found it through fightingbob.com. Look for Fighting Bob LaFollette himself on that website, fightingbob.com, and you will find Fighting Bob Radio. All programs are archived for future listening. Tell a friend. Tune in next week. I'm Eric Schubring. On behalf of Ed Garvey and fightingbob.com, thanks for listening.